Today, we talk about climate change and how good policies really can make a difference.
Do you remember when we used to talk about the ozone hole? And this was the big issue. It was actually bigger than climate change. Important to remember. Well, it's not exactly solved, but my goodness me, it is solved much, much more than we thought it would be. And there's some real lessons there.
Welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. I'm Bruce Edwards, and our guest today is...
My name is Andrew Steer, or Dr. Andrew Steer, and I'm the President and CEO of the World Resources Institute. And the World Resource Institute is a group of about 950 specialists, experts, working in 50 countries on the issues that bring together economic development and the natural world.
The main objective of the Paris Agreement, signed by 190 countries in 2015, is to reduce carbon emissions and ensure a transition to low-emissions economies. A new IMF paper looks at the role of fiscal policies in helping countries implement their climate strategies. Andrew Steer joined a panel on the topic at the Center for Global Development. Before joining WRI, Steer held senior positions at the World Bank and was the chief author of the landmark 1992 World Development Report that placed environmental economics front and center. Steer believes at this stage, simply reducing greenhouse gas will not be enough to prevent dangerous climate change. He says it's vital to work toward drastically cutting carbon emissions from the global economy, a process known as decarbonization.
So the Paris Agreement is all about reducing carbon emissions, but you have stressed the importance of decarbonization. How feasible is that process?
It's feasible. It is affordable. It will actually lead to a healthier, better economy and a healthier, better society. But we're not heading in the right direction. And the reason for that is partly lack of knowledge. It's also partly vested interests and general inertia. In order to get to where we need to get, it will require a remarkable transformation in our energy systems, in our buildings, in our transportation, in our food systems, in our manufacturing, and even in our consumption. But we've done a lot of work on this under the Global Commission on the Economy and Climate. We've shown that done smartly, there will be an economic gain of $26 trillion to world GDP between now and 2030. And there would be another 67 million jobs created.
And in this talk, you lauded this new IMF paper on the fiscal or the role of fiscal policy in mitigating the effects of climate change. Where does fiscal policy, why do you think that this is an important paper? Where does this fit into your world in terms of your work with the World Resources Institute?
Well, the only way that we can get the revolutions that I mentioned is if incentives change. And incentives are driven by a whole range of issues, including taxes and subsidies and public expenditures, which, of course, is fiscal policy. And so we now know, as obviously the IMF paper demonstrates extremely well, that the best single policy is a price on carbon, essentially a tax on carbon. And that's not the only policy that's needed. That in and of itself is not enough, by the way. There are several market failures going on here, but the biggest is the sort of the uncounted negative costs of climate change that nobody has to pay for until it's too late. So fiscal policy is very, very important. Taxation, how you spend the revenues of that taxation, how you manage risk into the future, all very, very important and very relevant to fiscal policy. And the IMF has done a great service to us all by the very serious work that is done.
But what does the green fiscal policy look like?
Green fiscal policy would be to go back and read what Professor Pigou wrote in 1923 when he came out with his famous book, and when he said, actually, it's sort of smart to tax bad things rather than good things. And unfortunately, we never really did implement that. And today we are taxing things that are actually very good, like your income. And we're introducing all kinds of distortions into the economy, which is really silly, when you could actually be taxing bad things, such as congestion, such as pollution. And obviously most important for this discussion is carbon dioxide and other forms of greenhouse gases, and we now know how to do it. Now, there have been several efforts to raise energy prices, and most of them fail in the sense that citizens get very upset and they often vote governments out or they force governments to back down. But we actually know that there are ways to introduce carbon pricing or taxes on fuel in a way that makes sure that the bottom one third of the income distribution doesn't suffer really negative impacts. And the IMF, again, has done a lot of work on that. They've reviewed the, I can't remember, 120-odd cases of efforts to reduce energy subsidies, and they've shown which succeeded and which failed. And sort of there's some pretty interesting patterns.
So on that, low-income countries are of the hardest hit by the effects of climate change, and they have fewer resources. How do you get the buy-in from low-income countries to sort of address climate-related issues when a lot of them would argue that they have bigger fish to fry, like immigration and conflict?
Well, I think the very vulnerable countries to climate change, there's no problem persuading them. They know far better than you or I know that they are severely threatened. Yesterday, I was in Fiji and addressing at the Asian Development Bank annual meeting, addressing the governors of the Pacific Islands. That's 14 Pacific Islands. It was their ministers of finance that were sitting around the table. And they asked me to talk on climate finance with a particular focus on adaptation and risk management, because these countries know very, very well. And so 4 years ago, Jamaica had Typhoon Winston. In 24 hours, it wiped out the equivalent of 35% of Fiji's GDP. Vanuatu had typhoon called Typhoon Pam the year before. The total cost was equivalent. It was a capital cost lost of 70% of their GDP. So these guys understand the issue. And of course, it's extremely difficult for them because they have limited financial resources. Fiji's now putting in place special taxes and going to use some of it to actually move citizens to higher ground, for example, safer ground. Well, they've got to put that against, should we provide more education for preschoolers? You know, I mean, this is very tough decisions. And when they have done nothing to cause the problem in the first place, nothing, it's also, quite frankly, a real moral issue. But then there are more complex issues that they have to engage in, is how much insurance should they buy? And they now have these parametric insurance systems whereby countries pool the risk. Sadly, we haven't quite got that right. There's one for the Caribbean, there's one for Africa, there's one for the Pacific. Not enough islands are yet finding that they have the resources to pay the premium. So that's not good yet. And I think we need some rethinking of that as we go towards the end of next year, where there'll be climate renegotiations and countries will be having to explain the financing they're going to provide. Rich countries will, and there needs to be a lot more financing for adaptation.
And so there was a lot of talk about carbon pricing today during this discussion. Do you believe that carbon pricing can actually drive development? And if so, why isn't it happening? I mean, why is there such pushback against carbon pricing?
Well, it actually is growing faster than most people realize. In 2004, only 1% of world emissions were under carbon pricing. Today it's 20%, so we still got 80% to go, but that's at least something. There are about 70 countries or administrative units, regions, that today have some form of carbon taxation, but more than half of them have a price under $10 a ton, and that's simply not enough. And so whilst it's good, it's not enough. Now, the question is, why do more not do it? Because it is very, very hard to persuade citizens that they should pay more for their gasoline and for their electricity. And that's where we really need to do a much better job of communications. Now, of course, you can use the revenues to reduce other revenues. So it can be carbon neutral. And the IMF paper does a very good job of explaining how you have to think that through, because what you do with the revenues will affect the overall distortionary impact on the economy or positive impact on the economy. If, for example, you use the revenues to lower other and more distorting taxes, then actually the impetus to the economy could be very substantial, because you're essentially taking out a whole bunch of distortions in the economy and helping in that regard. And then the other thing you have to do is think about who benefits, who loses. And those are two separate things. One, what does it do to the efficiency of the economy? Two, what does it do to the distributional impact? And that's where some countries have gone a bit wrong. They haven't realized, including the recent French effort to raise fuel prices, they haven't really thought through the implications of this for their citizens.
So none of these issues, these environmental issues, are new to you. You've been working on these for decades, actually. And you were the lead author of a World Development Report in your days at the World Bank in the early 90s. How would you compare the main issues of that report in the early 90s to today's issues? And what would that say, do you think, about the progress that we've made on these issues?
There are a few issues where we could say, my goodness, we solved that problem. I mean, I should say the analysis that we did in 1992 for the original Rio Earth Summit is still perfectly valid. It was good economics. It was the right things to recommend. The question is, why hasn't it been implemented? In some cases, it has. So, for example, do you remember when we used to talk about the ozone hole? And this was the big issue. It was actually bigger than climate change. It's important to remember, because people were having to, you know, wear extra suntan lotion and so on. Well, it's not exactly solved, but my goodness me, it is solved much, much more than we thought it would be. And there's some real lessons there. Incentives were applied. Public and private investment went into new technology. It was relatively easy to solve in the sense that not many companies made CFCs and HFCs and so on. And so it took the kind of a few, you know, DuPont-type companies to really become leaders, and they did a very good job. But real lessons there. So we've done a very good job. I mean, look, generally speaking, the air we breathe is certainly better than 30 years ago. I mean, remember the first Earth Day? You're too young to remember that, but the first Earth Day, which is in 1970, where hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Americans took to the streets and had you know, seminars and teach-ins and all that. Well, the interesting thing back then is that climate change wasn't really one of the issues they were talking about, because climate change wasn't really on the agenda. There were much more urgent issues, like, you know, remember the canal in Cleveland was on fire? You know what I mean? The dioxide and Silent Spring had just come out a little bit before, and Paul Ehrlich had just written the population bomb. So immediately after that, you know, within 6 months, we had the Clean Air Act in this country, the Clean Water Act. We had the establishment of the EPA. Amazing. And most of those problems have improved, I mean, quite frankly. I mean,
So we
have made progress. What we haven't done is we haven't made progress of the really big issues which require global collective action. You know, Eleanor Ostrom won her Nobel Prize for showing that the tragedy of the commons didn't need to be so tragic. Actually, people can get together and make common purpose and solve problems. The problem is that it's much easier at a community level where you have a common and common property that you can all negotiate. It's much harder at a global level. So that's why the climate change thing is such a knotty problem. And that's why in the period between Copenhagen, do you remember that was when we were supposed to in 2009? We were supposed to have a deal, and we failed. And then it took 6 years later, 2015, till we got a deal. The deals that were on the table were radically different. Deal number one in Copenhagen was a sort of textbook kind of deal, which would say, look, we're allowed to put so many tons of carbon up in the air, so we know how much we can put up, so we're going to allocate that to, you know, you're America, so you can only emit this much. You're Germany, you can emit that. And then actually we couldn't really reach agreement with low-income countries, so they can just relax for the moment. That didn't work because nobody was wanting that kind of global governance to tell them what to do. By 2015, totally different, totally voluntary, bottom-up. It was what the Americans used to call pledge and review. You know, each country makes an offer, and then the deal is you can make any offer you like, but we're going to watch you. And every 5 years, you've got to ramp up your offer. That's what the Paris deal is. And it's a much more, if you like, modern kind of bottom-up form of global governance. The problem is it could fail. It could fail if next year, when we meet again to ramp up those targets, if we don't manage to achieve it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. What a great pleasure.
Andrew Steer is the president and CEO of World Resources Institute. The panel on fiscal policy tools to protect our planet was held at the Center for Global Development. Go to cgdev.org to watch the webcast. And the IMF paper on fiscal policies for Paris climate strategies is available at imf.org. Thanks for listening. You can subscribe if you want to hear more, and you can follow us on Twitter at IMF_podcast.